Hi, this is Zach Hoskins from Dance Music Sex Romance, and this is part 4 of my conversation with Jane Claire Jones. This time we're going to talk about basically the things that we've been talking around for the last 3 episodes. This is probably the heaviest one, but I think we treat the material with the respect it deserves. And I promise it's not all going to be completely depressing. So with no further introduction, let's get to it.
Okay, so yeah, right. Let's talk about this. Let's talk about this whole processing and paddling around in the psychic Lake Minnetonka thing.
Yes, and you have notes on this, so I'm going to let you take the lead.
Oh, it's all going to get like very PowerPointy now. Okay, I mean, I think having listened back to what we've done before, I think we've made lots of allusions to. Potential narcissistic problems and potential problems with coping mechanisms and potential problems with certain kinds of defense mechanisms and how those were implicated in what happened. Right. So what we haven't really talked about, we've also made allusions to what is underneath those things, which we haven't actually talked about explicitly. And I think, you know, the people who have thought about this are kind of familiar with those. And I thought it would be quite useful if we just kind of went through them maybe and were a little bit more explicit about what we were talking about.
So right.
I have notes, but maybe you could start because otherwise I think it's going to be a little bit like point by point PowerPoint slide and I do not want to turn Prince's very human story into a series of PowerPoint slides.
Okay, well,
defense mechanisms and coping skills,
right?
Let's start there and then let's talk about what we think was underneath that.
Yeah, so I mean, and this is, we're kind of segueing from the conversation that I think will have been in the previous episode about Maite's book, where you see a lot of those in action.
Yes.
You know, there was, we've talked about cutting out people who disagreed with him or who challenged him. And this you can see all the way back to, you know, the 70s. I mean, you can see this in the way that Prince parted ways with his first manager, Owen Husney. It was like he told him something he didn't want to hear, and that severed not only the professional relationship but also the personal relationship. And you know, part of that might be because Prince was a professional musician from such a young age that for him, that dividing line between the professional and personal was very thin. And I think, you know, part of that was also, a coping strategy from childhood. He had a very rough childhood, and we've always kind of known this, like since there were biographies, and he's been, inconsistent about it, but I mean, people have been talking about whether Prince's childhood was troubled since 1984, you know, because Purple Rain came out, which depicted a very troubled family life. And then there was the whole discussion about, like, was his father actually abusive, which to me still hasn't been answered fully satisfactorily. It probably never will. And we just have to live with that.
Yeah, I think the question about whether his father was violent to him is unresolved.
Right.
I think Maite's book.
Maite certainly suggested that he was violent toward his mother. Because
his mother,
Maite,
yes.
Because Maite experienced that in her own home, and she remembers bonding with Prince about that, you know.
Yes. So I think the breakdown of their marriage was quite intense.
Right.
That's the impression that I get.
Right. And I mean, part of this is also, you know, this was the 1950s and the 1960s, and there are things that we call abuse now that we didn't really call abuse back then, you know, and so we get like the Larry King interview where Prince says, you know, my dad was a disciplinarian, but he wasn't abusive. And, you know, you see people arguing about this all of the time, you know, like, I mean, my parents beat me with a belt and I turned out fine, you know, so I mean, it's never going to be resolved because there's just so many factors, you know. But there was certainly he did not have an idyllic childhood. We can definitely say that.
I mean, there's issues about how authoritarian his parents were. There is his father anyway. I don't think it's the most significant issue. I do think it's an issue. I think the breakdown of his parents' marriage and how emotionally messy and potentially violent that was is definitely one issue.
Yeah.
I think his father's emotional remoteness combined with a certain kind of authoritarianism is definitely an issue.
Right.
There's a very, very interesting moment in the last Tavis Smiley interview when he's talking about how hard his father was on him.
Mm.
And then he says, oh, and the whole, you know, the whole Purple Rain line about, you know, don't get a woman pregnant and blah, 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 that whole thing. And then it's very interesting. He kind of pauses and he stops and he says, I didn't know what to take from that. And then he segues into talking about constructing his own worlds.
Mm.
And it's kind of a non sequitur, but
kind of
clearly it's kind of a non sequitur. My father was very authoritarian and what I decided to do was construct my own worlds.
Yeah.
But obviously emotionally it's not a non sequitur to
right.
him. And I thought that was quite interesting. And I think it also, if you take that part of the authoritarianism of his father and then you add what Alex found out about the fact that his stepfather was definitely abusive, I would say.
That I think has been established. Yeah, I feel like we could very safely say that's accurate.
It was one September day. Papa worked too hard. First he crucified every dandelion out in the yard. Then he screamed at baby twice for throwing rocks at passing cars. Baby didn't listen, so like a priceless work of art, he got snatched by his papa, who then opened up the closet door and pushed the 4-year-old down onto the closet floor. Baby cried, I'm sorry, I will not do it no more. Papa said, yeah, I know, that's what this here is for. Smack! Papa. Smack, smack. Ooh, papa. Papa. Smack. Papa. Smack, smack. Papa.
Drop the knowledge, boy.
That's abuse. Locking children in rooms and or in cupboards is abuse.
Yeah. There's no question.
Let's call a spade a spade. So those things I think kind of get linked to a certain extent and then produce this inability to tolerate anybody saying no, having any control over him, challenging him in any way.
And
his response to that is like, I'm the boss of me.
Yeah.
Like, fuck y'all.
he's unbending in that, you know, once he gets that control over his life, he refuses to sacrifice any control.
He is never, ever, ever going to let anybody do that to him ever again.
Right.
And I think that's what's under the extreme emotional response in the Warner's conflict.
Yeah,
I think that's what gets triggered, and that's what produces the amount of rage that appears to be going on underneath that. So that there's that, and so those are all factors. And it's interesting. I was looking at something came up in my Facebook feed the other day about like adverse childhood experiences and how you can kind of tally them up. And so we've already got quite a lot, and that's before we get to the most important one, which is his mother's behavior or lack of behavior in relationship to his stepfather's behavior, and what happened in terms of how it came to be that at 12 years old he left her house and she didn't stop him. She either was complicit. Firstly, she did nothing to protect him from whatever it was that his stepfather was doing, locking him in a room, making him do demeaning things, generally being abusive. You would expect, you would hope that in a situation like that, your mother would stand up for you. If she doesn't, that's a really serious sense.
Yeah, it's a violation of trust, you know.
That's a violation of trust. That's like, the world is not going to help me.
And
the person in the world who is there to protect me will not protect me.
And Touré, I think, talked about this in his book in a really interesting way. You know, he talks about how even though Prince had this very complicated on again, off again relationship with his father, you know, you can definitely tell that there was some trauma there. But he was, he would almost never mention his mother, you know, she,
no.
And when he did, it was like, not
almost,
good.
Almost never. The only times really, I mean, I went through them and kind of listed them. There are the explicit references to abandonment, of which there are very few. There's the one in the Motherless Child, in the 1999 Motherless Child performance, is the most explicit one, which is something along the lines of, how could you put me out on the street? I'm only 12 years old. Hey, Lula. Oh, mama, mama. Why you put me on the street? I'm only 12 years old. And the fact that he played that song quite often, actually. It came up several times, and the performances are quite emotional. There's Mama, which is just heartbreaking. I mean, lyrically it makes virtually no sense, but it's and it's compositionally very thin, but but it's very emotive. The vocal performance, because it's basically just him like wailing Mama over and over and over and over again, and then going, "Where's Dad?" It's really affecting. And then there's all the stuff about the weird stories about the Playboy magazines and the pornographic literature and the her being his wild side. And I mean, and that was one of the things. I'm not convinced about that story. I don't fully mm-hmm. understand that story. I don't know exactly how mm-hmm. it's linked in his mind. It certainly was something that he thought. I mean, he tells that story several times.
Right.
And this horrible docudrama that I watched basically just took that as read and then did...
Just literally,
took
yeah.
it took it as literally and then showed this picture of his mother in the mirror, like, getting dressed and essentially was like, Prince was sexually confused because his mother was a slut. And I was like, oh dear God. Right.
Yeah, there's a lot about Prince that's very Freudian. You know, like I talked about how I think the first post I made on the blog, I talked about how like that image of seeing his father on stage, it's like the fucking primal scene, you know, like it really, the way he describes it is so sort of like sexualized and, you know, like there's definitely some Freudian stuff. I mean, there's the fact that when his stepfather would lock him in the closet or the room or whatever, it was adjacent to a piano. So he was, you know, like literally just in an empty room except for a way to make music, you know, like this stuff is all very on the nose, but the Oedipal stuff I think is too on the nose even for Prince, you know, like I don't know if I buy that.
Yeah. And also, I mean, trying to construct a straightforward Oedipal narrative, there's definitely elements of it. It's too, you know, I'm a feminist philosopher, so I'm a little skeptical about the Oedipus complex as a general explanation right. of everything. Like,
right.
You know, partly because it's like, you know, I mean, again, it the extent to which that story about his father, I mean, and we have to call him Howard Bloom because Harold Bloom is a famous literary critic, and I always do exactly the same thing. And one of the
did we call him Harold Bloom?
We did. We called him Harold Bloom all the way through the last book, and then I was like, "Howard, I'm sorry, but it's And then I got a message. We got a message from someone saying, "I never knew Harold Bloom about Prince."
just Prince and Shakespeare. He covered all of the bases.
Yeah, no, not so much. But that whole story that Howard Bloom has about the passion point, yeah. I mean, again, that's much more, I would say, to do with the kind of genesis of that part of his narcissistic defenses. And
right.
The story about his mom is like, it's just way too much like cultural misogyny for my tastes. Like, it just sets my my alarm bells off. Like, maybe something weird happened there, I don't know, but you know, we've talked about this, like reading dirty books when you're 12 is not that unusual. Most of us read dirty books when we're 12. Like, you know, I remember, you know, when we were 11 or whatever, and we had Jackie Collins novels and, like, you know,
yeah, exactly.
sitting out the back of the bike sheds and being like, "Ooh, what does cunnilingus mean?" And like all of that stuff. Like,
yeah,
you don't.
So it's not necessarily that his mom had like a stack of Hustlers, you know, like it could have been any number of different things. It could have been, you know, or like tawdry romance novels.
It's like, not. It could have even just, you know, or whatever, or just like even just straightforward erotic literature. I mean, I don't know. At some point, he says that she gave him a Playboy magazine. Like the horrible docudrama then presented this as being an instance of. Because obviously, you know, in their Prince was sexually confused mind, Prince's mother was worried that Prince was gay because he was too sensitive and what have you. So she gave him Playboy magazines as some kind of, you know, just to make sure he was red blooded. And I was like, I don't think you actually needed to worry about that. I think that one was all right.
Right. Right.
But yeah, I don't know. There's something there. That bit of the story still doesn't hang together quite to me. There's something about the story that he tells about his mother being his wild side. There's something about the licentiousness of women and the uncontrolledness of desire, and how women's desire, if it's not sufficiently you know, managed by patriarchal social structures is civilization wrecking in its intensity. And there's something going on with that. I don't quite buy it. I don't quite buy it as an explanation of what he seemed to think it was an explanation of. And I don't think he ever went any further than that explanation. I think there's that famous Stephen Sutherland interview, I think, from 1981, where he says that he saw an analyst because he wanted to find out why he was so sexual minded. That's the first instance of him telling this story. But this story stays until 97. He tells it to Chris Rock in an interview, an MTV interview, I think, or VH1 interview in 1997. But he doesn't seem to have gone any further into that story, despite the fact, as we know, in relation to the whole Computer Blue scenario, this line, I'm obsessed with this line, when are you going to learn that women are not butterflies? I mean, I think the line maybe speaks more, and you could argue I'm overinterpreting it, but butterflies are things that you catch and pin and use as trophies. Like, there's something very poetic about the idea that you are using women as kind of tokens that you pull to yourself and try and pin down and collect because it's doing something for you. And I think there's something, I think that was a very, very perceptive image, and I'm not sure whether he was fully cognizant of how perceptive it was, but I think it's much more to do with that. I think it's much more to do with attracting cathexis to him, and I think that's also in that passion point moment that Howard Bloom noticed, that's what it was. My father is able to attract these women to him, and that has a kind of narcissistic, egoic quality to it, which I'm kind of impelled by. And if you take that and then you combine it with the issues that we've talked about, which is the thing with his mother, that's a very, very serious wound. Like, that's not a minor thing. And the fact that he then had almost no relationship with her for the rest of his life. If you think about if you think about Mighty's book, there is no mention of his mother. She never makes an appearance. In 10 years they are together.
Yeah.
Mighty never meets his mum.
Mm-hmm.
Not when they get engaged.
Yeah, she had to kind of go behind his back to meet his dad, but she never.
Yeah. So the father, there are issues with the father, but those issues with the father are at least recognized and acknowledged, and he comes in and out.
Right.
Because there's painful stuff with his dad, but the stuff with his mom is so painful that it's completely completely absent. Completely absent.
And as we know with Prince, if it's absent, that's the most painful thing.
Yeah,
the worst things
he will completely erase. I mean, in terms of this is also this whole kind of discussion that's been going on about Mighty's book about the burning of the ashes. And I agree, you know, it's kind of horrifying. But not completely out of character. I'm not saying whether he did or didn't do it. I understand that, given what Mighty would know about his personality, it's not inconceivable that when Mighty heard that, she would think it was possibly true.
Right.
Because it is not out of character for, in the most extreme circumstances, for him to completely erase things. So, I mean, we have several instances of this. We have We have the erasure of Wally after Susanna left.
Mm-hmm.
We have the bulldozing of the house, of the Galpin Boulevard house, after the marriage with Manuela breaks down. We have the burning of the ashes. Like, there are several instances of really quite stunning episodes of attempting to actually completely annihilate something. In quite extreme ways. I mean, bulldozing a house is fucking extreme.
Yes. I mean, yeah, most people would just sell it.
just sell the house, dude. Like, but like, no, I'm gonna get a team of people round, and I'm gonna raise this thing to the ground. Like,
right.
That's emotional. That's you know, that's something going on. It's the same thing. I mean, it's the same thing with it's always this moment of erasure, and the burning of Mighty's possessions, and whatever happened to the ashes. Yeah, I mean,
yeah.
And to a certain extent,
I mean,
speak. Yeah.
Honestly, even the song, you know, Comeback, which was, you know, he wrote about their child being lost, and has also, I've also seen it kind of raised as, you know, in the wake of his death, as something that's sort of meaningful, and it is meaningful.
I don't like it for exactly that reason.
Yeah, it's meaningful, but it makes me sad, you know, because of, like, it makes me sad on, like, a meta level. If you ever lose someone dear to you, never say the words they're gone. They'll come back. Like, this whole idea of, you know, like, don't admit that somebody is gone.
Exactly.
Because they'll come back. It's like, I mean, maybe it's, again, I'm not religious, you know, I'm agnostic. So to me, unless, again, I consider myself agnostic, not an atheist, I might be wrong, but to me, when somebody's gone, they're gone. You know, so I don't see the value in never acknowledging.
even like, I mean I'm philosophically, I'm also an agnostic, because I think it's the only philosophically defensible position. Like, we don't know. Like, you just have to, like, we don't know, yeah? We really don't.
Right.
I'm, you know, I'm quite foofy. I'm prepared to talk about all kinds of energetic spiritual experiences that I'm capable of having, and that I'm capable of sharing with other people in this in this plane of existence, which I think are real and meaningful. Like I said, I'm completely on the fence about the reincarnation thing. Even right. That notwithstanding, even if you believe in reincarnation, yeah, you lose a child, you feel grief. Like that is there. I mean, I think if you have to, you know, again, not wishing to bullet point it, but, you know, thematically, kind of what is underpinning the whole thing is an absolute refusal of mourning and an absolute refusal to deal with grief and loss and acknowledge it. And I think we talked about this as well at some point. I mean, I think that's what's one of the things that's so moving and I think so important about Mighty's book is the, you know, and we talked a little bit as well about people being like, well, why does she need to do this? And it's like, because her life story had actually been held under Prince's repression and refusal of grief for 17 years. And she just needed, I don't think Mighty doesn't strike me as being that kind of person at all. She strikes me as being very emotionally expressive and having great wisdom in understanding the importance of naming, like the way in which she insisted on Amir's name being witnessed and recognized, in naming things and recognizing them and honoring them and honoring the loss and honoring the pain. And I think that's why 17 years later, after this series of potentially really devastating events, her voice comes through with such light because she reckoned with it. And also what's so awful about that is that he couldn't cope with her reckoning with it. He couldn't cope with the fact that she fell into such profound grief because he couldn't go there with her. And that's part of the story of what pulled them apart.
Right.
And, you know, and then he abandoned her while she was bereaved. And
yeah, that's a rough part of that book. Just everything from, oh, you know, from obviously the Amir being lost, and then the way their marriage falls apart. And again, this is not, you know, that this did not encourage any kind of judgment from me. I was not like, you know, like fuck Prince, like, you know, what an asshole, you know, like,
no, it just makes me feel sad.
If anything, it was exactly, it's sort of heartbreaking. Yeah. That he could not handle this.
Yeah.
And, you know, he let his marriage fall apart. He, you know, arguably, the mind control is working on me again.
Prince mind control is serious shit, man. It's like you can see how that stuff went down. Like, yeah, man, I mean, really,
like I don't want to say it, but you know, they lose their second child, and I think a big part of it is because he would not allow Maite to go through the medical procedures that you know, in the late 20th century, we do to ensure that children are healthy.
Yeah, because he couldn't process it, and so everything was so unprocessed. I mean, I think that's one of the great tragedies. That's one of the huge tragedies, and it really breaks my heart because there is no reason he couldn't have had children. And it's obvious how mm-hmm. desperately he wanted children, and how, you know, Prince had a lot of problems, but he would have, in many respects, he would have been a phenomenal father, and
yeah. you know,
incredibly loving and incredibly encouraging and like huge amounts of fun. And like,
and that's one of the ways that we deal with childhood trauma is to do better, you know.
Well, that's exactly the issue. I think one of the things that was so important, he couldn't confront his own abandonment at all, but I think there was probably some mechanism in which he wanted to lay it to rest by doing better, by giving children, a child, other children, the kind of unconditional love that he had not been given, that he had been denied. And the fact that he didn't have that chance is, yeah, I think that's one of the hardest parts of the story for everyone to cope with. Because I think most of us think that had that not happened, he would still be here. I'm almost certain that he would.
Absolutely. Yeah, I definitely think that's true. And I just think it's so interesting that he goes from, you know, the Oprah interview, which was we all know, bizarre for many reasons. But, you know,
it's so painful to watch Mighty's face. The right. pain on her face is so transparent, and she just wants to please him. Right. And Oprah asks her where the baby is, and you can see the clench go across her face. Yeah. And then she just looks to him, and you know, he's got his arm around her, and she just wants everything. She's just like, just you take over, and like, I'll just do what you want me to do. And
yeah,
I understand why she did it. I mean, I think it's awful that he asked her to do it.
Right.
I understand why he asked her to do it, because that's what he, it makes sense within what we know about him. It's so painful to watch.
Yeah. But you know, he's talking about wanting like many children, you know, he wants children like hanging off of his neck, and like, and it's just interesting that somebody who wants that experience so much, would then for the rest of his life, you know, never try again, you know, never like never adopt a child, never.
Exactly.
Like, I think that is another, and this is total speculation because the Manuela years are really like a black hole. Until she writes a book, who knows what was going on?
You know, she's not. I would be spectacularly gobsmacked if she writes a book. She also knows that she doesn't have public sympathy in the same way that Mighty does, because she broke girl code. Big time.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, you know, I'll totally acknowledge I'm talking out of my ass here because, you know, this was the time that he was extremely shut down. You know, he was not like he had the not only the usual Prince veil of secrecy, but there was the JW veil of secrecy. And, you know, like this was not a time when he was very forthcoming with his personal life. But I think that this is another case of, you know, the repression. It's like he's never going to have a child again. He just puts that, it just compartmentalizes it. You know, he becomes not domestic at all. You know, he goes from being Mr. Domestic on Emancipation, you know, putting Amir's heartbeat on the track to, well, now I'm, you know, in my 50s and I just want to like party with celebrities nonstop. Like it's so transparent to me.
Yeah. Yeah. Because he couldn't process it. It was too painful. And so, and yeah. Sex in the summer. Getting it on. Give me that number. Yeah, it's really, yeah, it's horrible. It's horrible. It's the most heartbreaking part of the story, I think, because yeah, he could have adopted there are many ways that problem could have been managed, whatever that problem was. We will never fully know, but it could have been managed. There is no reason why he should have not had been able to have children other than the structure of his own defense mechanisms and his own coping strategies. And that's really heartbreaking. It's really, really heartbreaking because it's obviously something he wanted so badly that he couldn't process it at all. Yeah, and that story in Mighty's book about him carrying the heartbeat around and playing it to people. And the betcha by golly wow,
yeah, oh yeah, that was that I think was the and I think this is not like a Maite didn't break this story. I think people knew that was filmed after you know, after the child died.
I know, but it's incomprehensible.
It is.
It's just like, imagine where she's just like going, are you fucking kidding me?
Right?
Are you out of your mind?
Yeah.
Like, but it's that kind of, it's that thing. It's also the issue of the extent to which, you know, we've talked about the kind of repression mechanisms and the erasure mechanisms. And then on top of that, there's a whole raft of escape mechanisms.
Right.
And fantasy mechanisms. And there's escape into music. And as I've said, like, you know, that is not something I wish to denigrate because, you know, it was unbelievable. His capacity and what he was able to create in doing that. But there is also the issue of the extent to which that becomes compulsive and defense-like. But then there's also the kind of the building worlds and the kind of tendency towards fantasy and the desire to kind of reconstruct, you know, perfect moments. And she says, you know, she went along with it because she could see that he just wanted to go back to the place before it had happened where everything was okay. But that's not how you process loss. You don't, again, it's related to the comeback thing. It's like just pretend it's not real. And that kind of refusal of mourning, that we see there, we've also talked about at some point about the story about, I was really, there's been a couple of moments, particularly after his death, the one in which Taika, in an interview, said that she felt unable to grieve for him because he didn't like her to be sad, and because she's obviously, which is interesting as well, because that also makes me wonder to what extent that, like, don't grieve, don't feel bad feelings message was one that they both shared to a certain extent. I'm not sure.
And maybe, I mean, was their family very repressed in that way?
You know? Exactly. Whether that's a message that came through their parenting as well. Who knows?
Right.
I mean, in that interview, she said, I don't feel okay about it because he didn't like me to be sad. You know, which is just heartbreaking, both for her. And then also, again, because it's this repetition and a repetition of exactly the thing where you know, my first response to that was, you know, if your brother had been a little bit better with people being sad, you know, we wouldn't all be so heartbroken now.
Right.
Him not being here. Like, exactly. I just, it's so, you know, but I think, I mean, and this relates to, I mean, this comes back to the abandonment thing. Like, not only does that create a massive narcissistic wound, which mm-hmm. you really, which is going to really, really stay with you. And the less you look at it, the more it's going to stay there and the more it's going to amplify. And, you know, to return to the computer blue hallway speech, there are all of these negative feelings. We have the stories about, you know, the kind of demons and the increasing kind of manichaeistic split between good prince and bad prince and the demons and the love sexy, the Black Album and the story around the cancellation of the Black Album and that purported ecstasy trip and what was going on with that and him feeling that he was an instrument of the devil. You know, there are stories about him having nightmares and waking up and people asking him what was wrong and him saying demons. There's the whole kind of characterization of, I mean, that word in those IM messages between him and Manuela that were released when the divorce proceedings were unconcealed, the most interesting thing in them was that, firstly, like, what the hell are you doing? You just bulldozed your house. you tell your soon-to-be ex-wife, like, that you bulldozed the house and then you ask her how she feels and you're just like, whoa. Okay. But the thing that was most interesting, I thought, was that he said it was infested. As these words about kinds of this sense of there being like the part that his own negativity, his homebound feelings kind of then kind of pushing their way into consciousness in these various forms as demons, as infestations, as ghosts, as, you know, it's the kind of return of the repressed thing. And, and then the kind of increasing attempt to redouble the defense mechanisms in an attempt to kind of hold these things back. And to a certain extent, the whole conversion can be seen, I think, in that light as well, you know, and the story about the interpretation of Amir's death as a punishment, like that's also another version of that story. Like, I'm bad. There is something bad in me. That's this thing keeps, I can't get rid of it. And of course, because his mechanism is erasure, so I have to try harder. So I have to keep trying harder to get rid of the badness.
Yeah.
Rather than understanding what he understood somehow when he was younger, that you have these negative feelings, but he never got past the point of thinking that they were destructive and would lead to him being abandoned and would lead to people rejecting him and couldn't be tolerated. Because, and I think the thing that is really important is that not only is there the wound of being abandoned, what you don't get then is internalized self-holding. Like there isn't any mechanism by which you can hold your own bad feelings and then be okay. Like, there's no self-comforting. I mean, I think that thing about Mighty saying you couldn't bring him chicken soup, like the extent to which as soon as he was in pain, he couldn't be comforted. He could only escape. You couldn't just go, oh, I feel shit, and snuggle up and they're there and like just stay with it. You know, eat a bar of chocolate, like do what people do when they're comforting themselves.
That's like, just such a fundamental, like, you know, part of just life and relationships. And, you know, I mean, it's
you're going to feel bad sometimes. That's like that's a thing about being alive.
Yeah.
You're going to feel bad sometimes. And also, if you have abandonment issues and they're infracting on your relationships and all of these kinds of things, you're going to be in pain sometimes. Things hurt.
Right.
Being alive is painful. Like, not singularly painful, we hope. I mean, there's a really, okay, Alcoholics Anonymous have this phrase. And when I first, it's one of the most insightful things ever. And they say the pain is mandatory and the suffering is optional. And it's really right. Pain is a bearable thing. Like, right. Actually, if you can hold it, if you can hold it and you can process it and you're not scared of it and it's not repressed and it's not like it hurts. Stuff hurts. But stuff hurting is quite different from the kind of suffering that is produced by the refracting mechanisms of not dealing with pain.
Yeah.
And I think that's quite interesting in relation to it being an AA slogan and it being related to mechanisms of addiction. That the suffering right. is produced by the non-confrontation with the pain, actually. Happy in the way to meet your burden. No matter how stormy or dark the sea, pity on those with no hope for tomorrow. Them as bad as it seems until we agree. I mean, when I first started to engage with the story in more detail to try and work what was going on, the thing that really blew my head off was the thing with his mum. Like, what is going through your head when you leave when you let a 12-year-old boy just go out into the world on his own? Like, how did that happen? Like, what is going on that you are not like, don't be fucking ridiculous. You're 12. You're not going anywhere.
Yeah, I mean, again, yeah, that's the thing. Like, you know, Alex's book did cut through like some of the mythology, and some of it I've incorporated into my narrative, and some of it I honestly left the more mythical stuff because, like, no matter what the actual story was, and I totally understand, like, if you're, you know, if you're Chaz Smith or if you're Terry Jackson or, you know, if you knew Prince growing up at that time, I totally understand, like, wanting to set the record straight. And it's like, no, he didn't get kicked out of his parents' home or, you know, like, I understand all of that. But still, to me, and, you know, again, being from a different generation and like, you know, I have a child who's 5 now, and even when he's 12, I cannot imagine him saying, you know, "Dad, I want to go live with my friend Andre," you know, and being just like, okay, like, well, you know, whether it was genuine, like whether it was literal abandonment or not, to a child of that age, they're going to process it as.
I think what is absolutely clear is that Prince processed it as abandonment. Like, whatever actually happened, like, there is some reason to believe it seems relatively good reason to believe there was abuse. And then somehow, mm-hmm. under some circumstances, he left. And we don't know exactly how that happened, but it is clear it did happen in some way.
Yeah. And so there's Prince's like cinematic version of him, you know, in the phone booth crying, you know, and his dad saying, "No, you can't come back."
That is probably mythology. That sounds like Prince mythology to me. That right. You know. And the stories of like him having lived in 32 places and like, you know, the number, I mean,
I feel like the number was inflated, yeah. But the number, you know, but there's emotional truth in
there
mythology.
There is emotional truth, and the emotional truth is he felt abandoned and he felt alone.
Yeah.
Like those are very consistent and they come up over and over again. The amount of references to loneliness in the corpus are astonishing. I mean, even in a song like Shockadelica, which is like we discussed a few weeks ago, which is like la la la, super joyful. At the end right. of it, it's all like, oh, the lonely cold, blah blah blah. I'm like, where did that come from?
Shockadelica is a feeling, the lonely cold, sleeping alone, a boy, and soon you grow old. In lust, we will suffer, but in love, we will grow. Shockadelica, Shockadelica. Nobody should know. You're talking about the lonely cold, mama.
We were having a great time here, and now it's all the lonely cold again.
Right. I mean, Do Me Baby, it's like it's a slow jam, and then at the end he's whimpering and asking you to hold him, you know?
orgasming and whimpering simultaneously, right. And then going, it's cold, hold me.
Yeah, it is like, even in the sort of more like, you know, joyous or at least not sad moments of his discography, there is like, yeah, he always ends up, you know,
he always ends up alone.
I'm so cold. Just hold me.
Whatever the specific details are, it doesn't matter, actually, for the purpose of understanding him. What matters is what the emotional truth is to him. And he ended up at Andre's at some point, and right. his mother was never around. His child dies and his mother does not appear. His marriage breaks down and his mother does not appear. His second marriage breaks down and his mother does not appear.
Right.
Like, well, she was dead by that time.
that one wasn't her fault.
Some quite serious shit happens,
right?
And his wife's pregnant. I mean, she's just not there. So whatever. I mean, I'm not sure. You know, in terms of, I've not heard the details of what like Chad Smith and I don't know, because Jill Jones says that she was around and that she was okay. And at the same time, the Revolution, Wendy and Lisa say, well, uh-huh. we knew that we should never mention her. so there's quite a lot of conflicting stories about that.
Right. And, you know, knowing Prince, it's very possible that he was going back and forth rapidly between, you know, like, just look at his relationship with his father. Like, one day they're all buddy-buddy. The next day, like, he's getting married and he hasn't told his dad, you know, even though he's still living in a house that he bought for him, you know.
Yeah, three miles yeah. away. Like, seriously, I actually, I don't know because it didn't have scale, but I actually at some point pulled up Google Maps and, like, worked out the distance between Galpin Boulevard and Kiewit Trail.
Right.
It's not far.
Right.
It's not far, and he's there for the whole of his life. He dies in that house, and they never, I mean, it's not difficult to infer from that there's some abandonment happening. And obviously, probably by this point, his defense mechanisms have kicked in. And so we have all of these things. We have the escape mechanisms, we have the control mechanisms, we have the repression mechanisms, we have the kind of narcissistic seduction defense mechanisms, and how those mm-hmm. are related to various problems, and how that relates to the conversion, and then, you know, the yes men, and like all of this stuff. And then all of this kind of held together, I think, by a general like refusal of grief and a refusal of bad feeling and a inability. And it's not even a refusal. I just think he didn't have the mechanisms. He didn't have the internalized mechanisms. But what's really difficult is that he wouldn't allow, not only could he not come for himself, he wouldn't allow anyone else to come for him as well. And then you have, this is a slightly, and I'm not sure about this thought, but someone brought it up and I thought it was a really interesting thought. If you think potentially, so we don't understand this story about about what happened with his mum at the time that he left. But potentially, he says he's leaving. What seems to be the emotional truth of it to him is that he said he was going to leave and did his like swaggering I'm all right act. and his mum let him go, and he experienced it as his mum having chosen his stepfather over him.
Right.
And the fact that his mum didn't put her foot down and say no, and or potentially encouraged him in doing so. I don't think she threw him out. I suspect she didn't throw him out. I think he said he was going to go because he was being treated badly, and he was probably unconsciously trying to force the issue and expected her to step up and go, don't be stupid. And and she didn't.
Which is something, you know, that sounds very realistic to me in terms of like teenagers' way of dealing with things.
Yeah. And you know what P was like. I mean, he was like incredibly strong-willed and incredibly single-minded and very self-confident in a lot of ways and swaggering and probably just went, like kids do, and went, right, I'm off. And she, and I don't know, maybe she was trying to call his bluff. I don't know. Who knows what happened? But I think there's something quite interesting then about the repetition of those defense mechanisms and the extent to which, on some unconscious level, maybe he was always waiting for somebody to stand up to him and go, no, you're not going anywhere. Don't be stupid. All of the curving and pushing people away and putting up do not enter signs and all of that kind of stuff, like to what extent that was also, not saying that this is conscious at all, but is an unconscious, you know, the way in which these situations do is, you know, we re-engineer a similar situation over and over again to try and get a different result, to try and get somebody to go, no, I love you. Like, I'm not going to let you do that to yourself. And obviously, when you're an adult, that never happens. Because the only people that will ever do that really are, you know. And also because because obviously you engineer it this way. He'd chosen people who wouldn't do that.
Right.
He'd chosen people who'd go, yes, Prince. Yes, of course, Prince. What do you want, Prince? Like, so there was no one there. I mean, he could have at some point made that choice differently, but he hadn't. But that... You know, because of the whole story about the last few days as well, and the extent of him, like, everything's fine, I'm fine, everything's fine. You know, sending Judith back to LA, like, you know, sending messages to everyone, telling everyone he was okay. And, you know, and it's really, it's so hard because there's so many of these stories of people being like, oh, I thought I should go and see it, and Mighty saying, I thought I should go and bang on the door. You know,
right.
And people kind of knowing that almost the only way to get in would be to actually just turn up and bang on the door and go, what is going on? Are you all right? Like, and then, of course, because of the power of Prince Mind Control, they were all like, oh, no, that's a bit scary. I don't think we'll do that because he'll like go mad and shout at me.
I mean, that's the thing. Like, ultimate, like, you know, we're not blaming anybody in his circle for, you know, not being there, because
absolutely nobody's fault, saying because he'd engineered
that he's fine. And I mean, you know, I'm honestly, like, this might be oversharing or whatever, but I'm someone who has in the past handled emotions like that, like, you know, pushing people away so that they will, you know, like, tell me, like, intervene and say no, like, don't, you know, like don't go away, you know. And like you said, as an adult, it doesn't fucking work. Like, you push people away and they go away, you know. Like, that's like, I mean, maybe they'll come back like a couple times, but eventually they're just gonna stay gone, you know. Like, that's just, it just doesn't work.
Which is what happened over and over again. Which is what happened.
Exactly. So it's like, ultimately, I mean, the fault, if we want to call it a fault, is with him alone. Like you need to
absolutely. Absolutely.
You can't tell people one thing and expect them to behave in the opposite way. Like that's just, no. You know.
No. And again, I mean, this comes back to the non-processing, like the not being able to look at what was underneath it and the not being able to confront the pain of what was underneath all of those mechanisms. Like,
right.
You know, there was this kind of constant dealing, not constant, but, you know, the repetition of the return of various symptoms and the effects, the certain negative effects of certain aspects of the defense mechanisms, and the patterns stay the same. You know, mm-hmm. It's kind of interesting again in relation to this whole chameleonicness because the behavior is remarkably consistent.
yeah.
And yes, no one is responsible. No one is responsible because you're an adult, and the only person that can change those things is you. And the only way you can change them is by confronting what's underneath them. And it was too painful. And he couldn't do it, and I don't blame him for that. It makes me immensely sad, because if he had been able to do that, then I think things would have been very, very different. But I think the thing that is so sad is, you know, is the extent to which, if it is true that, you know, the point he did actually reach a point where he asked for help, and it was too late.
Yeah.
That was a real gut punch, I think.
Yeah.
And possibly too late by hours.
Right. Like,
that was really hard, I think, for everyone to deal with as well. Yeah. Particularly because, you know, the extent to which, you know, whatever his fears were about how he would have been judged or how that would have come down or how people would have responded to him, I think, and everyone's sense is just like, mate, we've got you. Like, it would have been fine.
Yeah.
Like, the whole world would have got you. Like, really. And then you end up feeling like, you know, you listen to the concerts in Sydney in February, and you know, the thing I love, one of the things I love about listening to the audience in Prince Bootlegs is, like, you can hear these really big, burly blokes go, "I love you, Prince!"
You know, yeah,
it's not just women screaming,
right?
It's like proper doodly dudes going, right. "I fucking love you, mate."
Yeah. Yeah.
You can feel it in the room. Like, I love, one of the other things I love about the book, I love listening to the encores. Like, you can feel the energy, like the mm-hmm. way they lose it when he gets on the stage, like the minute he walks on and you can hear everyone screaming and you know, all of that. Like, you can feel the intensity of the devotion, and
yeah,
you can hear it in his voice. He can feel it, like it mm-hmm. feels real to him. And so on one level, there's like, you know how much love there is for you. You know you're loved. And it's still somehow not enough for you to trust that the world will catch you.
Yeah.
Like, your friends will catch you. Like, we've got you. It's all right. Like, that abandonment thing was so unprocessed that all of that love was not enough. And that's why it was so painful, I think, right. for everyone. Because it was just like, how can someone who is so loved feel so alone they can't trust enough to just ask for help? Like,
yeah,
that's a real gut punch.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've processed it and tried to explain and looked at his mechanisms, and his mechanisms were, and there's no movement. He makes no, I mean, that's the thing, when you were talking about Alex's book and the fact that it finishes in 1988 and it's like all the pieces are in place and it doesn't change.
Right.
Like, and it's funny because Prince would always say, well, I'm always changing and I'm always evolving. And it's like, actually, emotionally, you haven't actually changed yeah. that much at all for the last 30 years.
Right.
Like, your defense mechanisms were all there. And they're all working in exactly the same way. And your spirituality has changed, and you've changed some of the narratives that you tell, and some of your fantasies have changed, and your hairstyle has changed.
His hair definitely changed a lot. I think that is accurate. His hair was constantly evolving.
No, but even in the last 10 years, the hair was kind of the same. I mean, that was like, that was kind of like... It's like,
And he went full circle too. Like he, you know, the hair actually went back to how it was in 1978. So
yeah, no, exactly. It's just, there's probably when you're like trying to categorize pictures from the noughties and you're like, I can't work out the year from your hairstyle. It's really It's really frustrating. Yeah. it's not even the hairstyle or like the month.
Right.
But actually, in terms of, you know, just to keep moving, we've talked about this as well. Always the future, the time does not exist, the past does not exist. Like that refusal of the past, you know, and that and future orientation is great. Yeah, it's really important as human beings to keep moving. But you like the past ain't going nowhere. Like the present and the past are completely intertwined with each other. And the only if you want the past to really go away, you have to process it. That's the only way to release it. Like otherwise, you're carrying it with you. And the more he talks about the past not existing, the more anxious it makes me feel. The more it makes me feel like, about the birthdays, I mean, that really, to some extent, sometimes I had one thought about the extent to which that was actually just about, you know, because there's all these stories about him in his 20s just like being alone for Christmas and him calling up girlfriends and getting them to like fly out on Boxing Day or whatever, and you end up thinking that actually, you know, this, I don't think this is the main thing, but actually it makes me end up thinking that the whole JW thing about not celebrating holidays was actually probably
part of the appeal.
It's part of the appeal because it's like I don't have to deal with this horrible time where I'm supposed to be with my family and I haven't been with my family since I was however old. We have no record of him spending holidays with his family ever, or birthdays, or him getting cards from his parents, or all of the normal stuff that you would expect. And that's gonna hurt. Like that's gonna hurt. It's gonna hurt. That's gonna hurt every time. That's gonna hurt every damn time.
Yeah.
You know, so that doesn't go away, no matter how much you talk about the non-existence of the past. And like, I mean, we've said like he had an. I mean, this is the whole thing about the flow. He had an incredible capacity to exist in the present. All the time he was on stage, I believe him. All the time he was making music, I believe him that it wasn't there. Like he was all in the moment. Like. And with an incredible like degree of energetic commitment but as soon as you stop, it hasn't gone. Like it's still there. It's still there.
At some point you have to, even if you're Prince, you have to come out of flow, you know? Like at
you
some
can't
point,
you can't like... exactly. And then you're there, and there's your personality, and there's all the pain, and there's everything that's repressed, and there's all of that stuff, and that's not going anywhere. It's not going anywhere unless you look at it, you know. And we've talked about this. There's a bit, you know, we've talked about kind of empty room and why I find Empty Room such a moving song, because I think there's also, partly because it's an image of abandonment, obviously, and he's there and Susanna's left him because he's pushed her away, probably. And then he's sitting there and he can't cope with it. He can't just sit. He doesn't know what to do. He doesn't know what to fill the space up with. Like, I know that feeling. Like, that's containment failure. That's like containment failure. That's like, I have all this bad feeling and I just, and I don't know what to do with it. And, you know, in the Montreux performance, you know, and he plays this incredible guitar solo, which is somehow, like, utterly desperate and ecstatic at the same time. It's like, I don't know how you do that. But it's got everything in it. There's rage, there's, like, you know, pain, there's, like, joy, there's transcendence, there's, like, victoriousness, there's, like, it's amazing. It's an incredible thing. It's just, like, this massive wail of, like, wah! Which, also, it being Prince, is also simultaneously orgasmic. And it's like Jouissance rage. It's, like, unbelievable. Right. It's incredible. It's, like, orgasmic fury. It's phenomenal.
Lonely hearts, worlds apart. Why then should they be broken? We could be somewhere making love. Love is strong, however long. We should have been forever. Why'd you leave me?
And then he stands on the stage and he says, like, what's the point in crying? And I'm just like, part of me just wants to get up and just kind of, like, shake him until the tears come out. Like, literally shake the grief out of him.
Right.
Like, I'm just like, can I just pick you up and squeeze you until water just, like, comes out of your face? Just let it fucking go.
Barren walls, tears fall. What's the use of crying? I've got to find a way to feel this empty.
And all there was that thing is like, me sit down and do my intellectual thing and be like, okay, can I explain to you about mourning? Like,
yeah.
And the return of the repressed, and here's how this thing works, and your whole time does not exist thing, and the difference between like presence and flow and repression and all of this shit, because like, this is not going to work, dude. Like, you can't stay in the present all the time, all the time, all the time, all the time, all the time. You have to look at this. You have to look at it. And And he never does. And he never does. And like, I don't know. It's like, I have this, you know, I've said, like, I have this fantasy moment where I'm like, I can get on the stage and like squeeze it all out of him. Like,
if
he's
can go back in time. Yeah.
I mean, you see me like pole vaulting onto the stage in the auditorium. What's it called? Stradivinsky or whatever in the Montreux Jazz Festival. I mean, like, dude, I'm here from the future because this whole not crying thing. Yeah. It's going to go really bad and you're going to break the entire world's fucking heart. Yeah. So like, I'm here to squeeze this motherfucking grief out of you right now. Like, please, you know? And like, yeah, it's both comic and also I just, you know, and yeah, no, what's the use? Why does this water squirt out of my face? I don't know, because it gets it out of your body and stops you carrying it around forever. Mm. That's why.
Yeah. Yeah,
I think it's an amazing defense mechanism. It's the best of all the emotional. It's an incredible thing. Human's ability to cry. It's phenomenal.
Right.
I had to teach myself because I had a similar thing. Like, I had containment failure, so I had to teach myself to cry when I was in my 30s. I had no idea. I used to think when people were sobbing, they were just making weird strangled noises in their throat. Like, I didn't get it. I was like, I would get slightly upset and then I'd get this kind of fizzing feeling in my head and then small amounts of water would squirt out the front of my face and like a strangled noise. That was it. Couldn't get any further. And I actually had to teach myself to sob. And it was the most important thing I did in my entire life. Like, it's revelatory. Like, I have all this bad stuff and then I can actually just excrete it out of my body. Mm-hmm. What an incredible evolutionary mechanism that we then somehow large vast numbers of us, partly because of gender bullshit and other reasons, end up not utilizing.
Right.
It's like the cortisol will literally be excreted out of the front of your face. Like, it's like you just, yeah, there's something about that line, what's the use in crying? And it's like, God, I've just, seriously, how long have you got, friends? Can I tell you?
And I think, you know, I think this is a good way to wrap it all up, because, you know, part of why we've been doing this, you know, like we started this series with talking about, like, why have we spent the last year in an obsessive spiral about a dead rock star, to put it bluntly.
It's kind of embarrassing, really.
Right. But, you know, and so part of it is because we were all left stunned and we needed an explanation, and we've all come up with our own explanations, and, you know, this is ours, and I feel pretty good about it, certainly, at least for my purposes.
I found it to be an explanatory explanation for my own purposes anyway.
Right.
I'm not going to say it's true. I'm just going to say it's explanatory, and it is. It seems to hang together, and it helps. It helps me anyway.
It's true enough, I think. Yeah,
it's true enough. Yeah.
And the other part of it is, you know, there is that, like, if I mean, maybe we couldn't, you know, like, we probably couldn't have saved Prince, but, you know, maybe somebody could have, you know, like, and I think it's valuable to think our way through these things, and you know, even completely apart from Prince. Like, think about, you know, how we want to live our lives and how we want to deal with our feelings. And, you know, like, I think this can be kind of a cautionary tale in some ways, because ultimately, like, you know, yeah, it's beautiful that he created this universe and, you know, Paisley Park and all of that stuff. Like, that's great. And the art is, you know, always going to be with us, and I wouldn't trade it for anything, but
no, none of us would,
you know, there's some real danger in not dealing with the things that you need to deal with. And, yeah, you know, if even just like from being a fan of Prince, we can walk away from it with maybe our own coping strategies need some work, you know, like that there's some value in that.
Everyone does, but I think that's why, you know, and we've talked about it, you know, despite the incredible power of posthumous Prince mind control injunctions, we kind of feel that it's important to talk about it, because the repetition of the don't say anything bad and don't say anything negative and respect his privacy and he wouldn't like it and don't psychoanalyze him and blah, 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 and all of that stuff, you know, it feels like it is both colluding with so many of the factors that were implicated in what happened and also failing to use, you know, I don't want to turn him into a teaching point, like, you know, but...
Yeah.
But also... when horrible things happen like this about people that people have such emotional connection and resonance to, it is a chance to learn something about ourselves and about what it is to be human and how we deal with our emotional landscapes and how we can strive better to be healthy. And because his death caused a huge amount of pain, and I'm not blaming him for it, and I'm not saying,
right,
you know, but a lot of people were very, very hurt and are still very hurt. And I can't imagine for a second he would have wanted that. And I know people are like, you know, and even now people are saying, don't grieve him, he wasn't scared of death, and la la, you know, and it's like when people were brought into the atrium and shown the urn. Like, and the urn, right, was kind of sprung on them, and people were like, ah. And then the tour guides were like, oh, don't cry, Prince wants you to be joyful.
Right.
And it's like, this is not a joyful thing. Like, right, this is not a joyful death. Like, this was a very painful and dark way for someone who was so luminous to die. And it was very, very shocking. And there's something in that. There's something in that about, you know, the importance of light and the importance of accepting darkness into the light. And
yeah,
and I would hope, you know, as I've said, I'm agnostic. If he is anywhere, his soul knows that now. And that he wouldn't begrudge us talking about this now. that's what I like to tell myself. anyway.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I would have filled up many swear jars at Paisley Park, so I'm not really, I have no illusions about you know, ever getting Prince's
approval.
You
think I'm going to turn up and not kill you, motherfucker? Are you joking? No, I mean, yeah.
Oh.
I think processing it as honestly as possible is, you know, is a respectful way of dealing with it, and mm-hmm. Not repeating or not necessarily feeling that his injunctions were completely correct. Prince was not always right.
Right.
There are significant things Prince was not right about, and this was one of them. And
right.
And I don't think that's something that necessarily should be repeated, and it should not be required as a kind of loyalty test to his memory. And I hope that, you know, I hope that it's clear that it's possible to do that in a respectful and loving way. And it's what Mighty said as well, you know. Mm-hmm. People are like, oh, you've said these things about him and blah, blah, blah. And she's like, it comes from a loving place. And that book really clearly comes from a loving place. The love she has from him is on every page, even when she's talking about him doing the most horrible things. And yeah. It's, again, like, there can be darkness and light together. There can be honesty and recognition of darkness within love. It doesn't always have to be Paisley Park, like, shiny, happy clouds in the sky, lovely butterflies and rainbows land. Like, right. That's all great. That's all great, but, you know, not when it's just insistently layered over real pain, which mm-hmm. is real and is part mm-hmm. of life. So that's what we have to say, I guess. We managed to fight our way through 2 hours of anxiety. Anxiety about being struck down.
Right.
And we didn't even talk about drugs. There we go.
No, we did. You know, I mean, that is like, honestly, that's the least important thing to me. You know, I think
it's
he had a reason for taking them, you know, and even if he didn't, you know, people cope with things in different ways. I don't know.
I think it was a coping strategy of last resort that got out of hand towards the end. And there isn't that much more to it than that. I mean, there's an interesting kind of issue about the, you know, about erasure and opiates and pain and erasure and how that works. And I mean, we did talk in the other conversation, I don't know whether we can add it in, about the, you know, about the extent to which the joint pain, if there is, yeah, I mean, and I believe that the joint pain was a real thing,
right,
and a significant factor, and obviously the extent to which he had to keep performing, like, not financially speaking, but because mm-hmm. because that being in presence was the core of his way of dealing with the world, and his way of not having to confront these things. And that's not to say, you know, and I've said, that's not to say it's meaningless or pointless escapism. It wasn't. It was utterly transcendent escapism. It was utterly transcendent escapism that gave vast quantities of people unspeakable amounts of pleasure. But there is also this extent to which there is this kind of compulsive aspect of it. And you know, one does wonder about the extent to which the pain then in the body is in a certain sense a kind of transfer of the pain that was driving the necessity of the incessance of the activity, like the just the inability to just sit down and just
right.
be and just be right. with himself and. And the intolerableness of that, and the sense of which, you know, people were like, oh, you know, some people will say, you know, oh, he works himself to death for us, and it's like, no, he works himself to death because that was how he had
for
to
him.
Be in the world,
yeah, right.
for himself,
right?
Yeah, it was not. It's not an enormous act of charitable self-sacrifice. Like, he had to do it. Like, that was that was where he felt good. That was where everything was okay. That was where he was alive and luminous, and there was no pain. And there is a question about the extent to which, again, that then is also in a certain sense implicated, because he just had to keep going. And I think the idea of not being able to keep going would have been utterly intolerable to him. Like, I can't imagine how he would have dealt with that thought. His performance history is fucking insane. It's insane. And everyone's like, oh, you had to do it. And it's like, no. He did it. He did it for himself. I mean, mm-hmm. and for us, sure. But that was not the... Learn to cry, kids. That's the moral of the story.
Yeah, so I mean, we're done talking in this particular you know, instance, but I think I know that I at least am, you know, I'm going, I've in some ways consign myself to, you know,
you've undertaken a lifetime mission, Zach.
I don't feel yet like I've bit off more than I can chew, per se, but there are going to be many more years of me obsessing about Prince.
In 15 years time, when you get to the rainbow children, we'll see how you're doing.
Yeah, so I mean, you know, you're gonna hear a lot more from me, and I imagine. I mean, you know, at some point, Jane needs to, like, you know, write a book in her field of study. But
they don't let you write philosophy about rock stars. That's definitely not. So I'm gonna write this crazy, rambling, philosophical / psychoanalytic / spiritual woo woo piece of analysis about a dead rock star.
And right.
I can imagine there is an enormous market for it.
Yeah, well, I mean, at least, yeah, I think you have an audience here, at least, so.
I do, and I think it probably just has to be written anyway,
yeah.
for my own intellectual peace of mind.
Right.
Putting this amount of intellectual labour into something and then not doing anything with it is an affront.
Exactly.
but there was also, like, there's the conference. I was going to come back and give a roving conference report.
Yes, I'm eager to hear about, because I wish I could be there, but again, just, you know, like, unfortunately, international travel is not in the cards right now for me. But I'm excited to hear about Salford and about the state of Prince scholarship. And
I really don't know, because I mean, there's a little bit of Prince scholarship. I mean, I'm hoping there will be a lot more of it now. Anyway, it will be fun. I'm looking forward to it. I'm gonna get myself a little Perspex Prince necklace made just for the hell of it. Cool. All right. So we done.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for spending all of these hours talking to me. It was a lot of fun.
I've enjoyed it. As I said, all of that insane intellectual obsession needs to be put somewhere. Otherwise, you do slightly start to lose your fucking mind. And none of my friends care. I have to say, I've tried really hard. My best friend really likes the music. Other than that, mm-hmm. she's just like, yeah, whatever. But almost everyone in my life is like, why has Jane fallen into a crazy purple rabbit hole? And when is she coming back? It's like, I send the bits of my writing and they're like, this is really beautiful. I still don't care about Prince. And I
was right.
Like, I don't know what to do. I can't explain. It really matters to me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and thanks for listening, those of you who are listening, and the podcast will come back in some form at some point, so
thanks very much, guys.
All right, bye-bye. Thanks again to Jane for talking to me for these last four episodes. Like she said, she will be at the Purple Rain Interdisciplinary Conference in Salford in the UK. So if you're on that side of the Atlantic, by all means, come see her. Come listen to her. I'm sure her paper is going to be amazing. I, as usual, will be right here on princesongs.org. And, you know, we've got more coming from the podcast. I've got a little bit that I recorded with Jane that I wasn't able to find a place for. So I'll be dropping that at some point. In the meantime, let me know what you want to hear, because we're kind of, with these four episodes out of the way, I'm not really sure what direction to go in. But I've got a feed, and I don't want to just leave it dormant after so short a time. So, if you have any suggestions for where we should take the podcast, by all means, drop me a line. And in the meantime, thanks for listening, and come back to princesongs.org.